conversations that were going on there. Talking about some kind of work project that he was excited about, and also his social life, which currently included some kind of social gymnastics to make sure that he looked good. So the content of what he was talking about mostly covered the future and about his plans about how to control it and manipulate it for himself. And his style. That her roommate had brought it home from something because she had a jacket just like that, but when she got home she realized that her jacket was over there, and so she had taken a jacket which just looked exactly like hers, but which she hadn't actually brought with her originally. And so having now two of this kind of jacket, she offered it to this woman from the bus stop. Happy about that, and she was joyfully accepted it and started wearing it. And there was no sense that this situation might have to be ethical dimension. And there was certainly no mention of the person, the other person who had lost their coat. Somebody took the wrong coat. So although we were just calling it for examples, right? We were very thankful for this very different time. I didn't really feel strongly judgmental. But I did have the clear understanding that this was unskillful speech. And the effect of it will eventually be poor results for that. So I can understand it. It's only possible to speak like that if one is not in one place. Basically, mindfulness is a protection against some degree against this kind of behavior, because it allows us to feel the impact of what we actually is and of what we're saying on our own being. Maybe that there wasn't any immediate effect on the other person that they were talking with, that they were just sharing their experience. But they weren't really that kind of speech actually improved a lot of stress and tension and that kind of contraction, So I thought I'd talk today a little bit about different qualities of speech and making those choices, and also about the views of the parents that inform how we speak. They were very much part and parcel of each other. There are four forms of speech that the Buddha wrote out as being unskillful, or harmful, or unethical. It's interesting that these are all kind of the same concept. Probably what we would translate, what we would call unethical, probably that's what the Buddha would call unskillful. So these four types of unethical speech are speech that is false, that is divisive, that is abusive, or that is sort of the four cues, if you will. And I noted when our mindfulness is strong, we'll feel that these kinds of speech are actually critical for us. And we don't feel good that we're doing it. Also, we'll notice if you're mindful that this kind of speech increases our access to wisdom. So that means we have more poor decisions for our community, including the kindness of people. It also socially alienates people sometimes, and reduces our fear of thinking. So, but as mindfulness becomes greater, and has greater inner peace, then it becomes clear, actually, that the cost of this is very high. Because when you feel that stress, you realize that the more modern language, the cost-benefit analysis is not really working out. There may be perceived benefits of mindful speech, but they're usually kind of short-lived. So I thought I'd just maybe expand a little bit on a couple of these, that these terms are not always totally clear. Speaking falsely, I think it's pretty clear. But divisive speech is speech that is intended to drive apart people who are united and to further their division. That there are some people who delight in attention, who delight in individual. They can ask, what do they do? Why would that feel good to some people? Probably it's related to conceit of some kind, you get to feel special. They're somehow part of a special group that derives its identity from being different from the body from us and them. There's a certain clarity about creating an identity. And so people who are not paying attention to the cost can feel good. Abusive speech is also fairly clearly labeled, but it's interesting how the group describes it. He describes it as being harsh, cutting, hurtful, offensive, connected with anger, and unproductive of confrontation. That's an interesting one, right, to put on the end. We can understand all of the initial answers, or what we were becoming theologists, and if we can come up with our own definition. But unproductive for concentration, it shows that there's a way in which abusive speech educates beyond concentration and requires the mind to be herself and still and at ease with being in the present moment. And if we can keep them beautifully, it disrupts that tendency. And so people who don't have any experience with the wonderful benefits of concentration, or even in the jhana, even just the benefits of the mind of the person, it's simply calm. We probably don't, we don't understand that the abusive speech would be an obstacle to that kind of happiness. Even if you haven't meditated for very long, most people have experienced some kind of meditative happiness. Even people first sit, sometimes I had no idea that it was possible to just sit down and feel something. And this is not a random occurrence. It's not urban people seeing sometimes that really have the ability to jump. I can't tell you how many people say, oh, I tried meditation, but I didn't get it. So it's like, okay, we're trying to jump. This is not a inborn ability that you have at any time. It's a skill. Anybody can develop it in certain ways. And so, but it's not random. The ability to develop meditation depends on believing in certain ways in the rest of your life. And going, even though that abusive speech is something that hinders your development of meditation. Just how it works. So I feel somewhat compassionate. I don't feel compassionate. I feel somewhat sad for folks who are generating a lot of anger and anger of thought and speech. also pointless speech. Speaking at the wrong time, speaking of what is not real, or of what is useless, contrary to the Dharma, worthless, unreasonable, immoderate, and unbeneficial. So, that's a lot of things piled on there. But it's, you know, the idle chatter, lots of comments that are made just to basically say, I'm here. It doesn't necessarily mean that the simple chit-chat that you hear with people on the bus is automatically connected. There can be a point to that, to connect with the person that you're talking with, or to provide some reassurance to them when they're just talking about the weather. But, you know, we need to be aware. One of them is speech that is not real, by the way. Something like that, that is, that includes things like exaggeration, pointless commentary, or telling tales, not telling tales as if they were real. So you can tell tales, but just say that it's totally important. So why do we speak in those places? Just in case we recognize and feel real. Because we all, you know, we all have challenges in our speech. If we were singled it out, because it's such an important area, you could have just made a point of action. Why is speech separated out from why is anything like that? Because it's so important. It's such a difficult area. So why do we speak in that way? It can be that, we have an idea that speech is a means of expressing our opinions and our views, and that is automatically valuable. We can feel somehow justified in saying whatever it is we agree. If I believe it, then it's okay for me to say it. We might have that idea. But regardless of whether or not that's a cultural norm, these indications about why speech suggest that there's maybe a higher standard in what we could live to if we were committed to reducing stress. You only have to look at social media and public discourse to see the core effect. Most of the great conflicts in our society today are not conducted on battlefields of armed confrontations. They are fought verbally and mostly unsuccessfully in the arenas of everyday conversations, political speeches, TV and on the web, social media, books, bumper stickers, clothing, and even hats. The degree of hostility and vilification with which opinions are spoken has become a prominent social poison, creating so much divisiveness, discord, and ill will that factional strife is now more prominent than conflict over almost any other social issue. Important social issues are being eclipsed by the intensity of communication that is false, divisive, abusive, and conflict. This is for quality. Just go and read Facebook. False, divisive, abusive, and pointless. Check it off on each one. They're not all like that. This is worth maybe bringing some consciousness to. It's not intended as some kind of a scripture or a commandment. It's really just an awareness thing. You know, check in your mindfulness. How do you think and feel? Do I want to participate in that kind of thing? If I care about my own heart and mind and my being. The good news is that the Buddha also defined four kinds of skillful speech, and this is speech that can for peace, can especially the initial mindfulness. When you're speaking in that way, the mind gets a little bit darker, and it's actually harder to be clear about that. Whereas if you have a clear brain awareness and you're speaking in the initial way of talking about it, there's sort of an enhancement of the clarity. So mindfulness is compatible with the one speech in a way that it's not compatible with the unconscious speech. So that's one more thing, if you have a mindfulness practice and you dedicate to being mindful in your life, you'll need to speak in certain ways in order to support that practice. So you might guess the skillful speech is pretty much the opposite. It's speech that is true, that creates concord, that is inoffensive, and that is beneficial. So it's not that you always have to check off all four of those boxes, but again, this is a guideline. And they're pretty clear, you know, speech that creates concord, speech that reconciles those who are divided, or speech that further harmonizes those who are already together. You kind of smile just thinking about speech like that, and I mean, there are people who are good at that, in a sense. The Buddha says there are also people who love concord, which I think is kind of sweet. Speech that is beneficial. Words that are kindly about what is real, beneficial, concerned with the Dharma and an ethical life. It's also said that beneficial speech is spoken with clear explanations, delineations, and benefits. So beneficial speech can include speech that has clarity to it, where you state very clearly what it is that you will do or not do, and you actually have to do on that. Delineation. So beneficial speech can be reinforcement of anger. I'm sorry, I don't have time for that today. Beneficial, the other person understands. You've benefited yourself by making it clear what it will be. So it's not that skillful speech automatically means you have to just comply with what's going on or accept everything. But there's a certain clarity of strength. With another practitioner who is just discovering in her practice a layer of meat that she can operate in. I was really excited by this because it's such a great development in practice when you start to see the communities that you're operating with. And you're going to do it many times because there's a lot of layers of them. But it's amazing how many communities you live by about how the world is, how other people are, how we are, what things mean in our lives, so many. And we tend to think of the word views as just meaning an opinion, what's your view on measured grounds, things like that. But it's actually, in this practice, it's meant to be much more nuanced and much more integrated with our whole system, actually. And that when you have a view about something, it affects what we perceive. If you decided that you walk into a room and you decide emotionally that it's not a safe space for some reason, that becomes our view, our lens through which we see it, and our orientation. And then we see everything about it that doesn't look good for us. It doesn't look right or safe or comfortable. Whereas just having a different view, maybe even a view of, oh, what could I learn from this space? Or a view of, oh, this is fun. Will bring a different perception. And it's not that we're trying to find the exact correct view, or that we're going to decide on the view that we always have and plaster that onto every situation. Not at all. But we should be aware that the view of clarity affects actually what input we are buying in. So we are not neutral observers of the world. We have a lot of things that are automatically there. And mindfulness allows us to adjust the feedback. And then you discover that those views affect very much what we try to say in a certain situation that is coming in the way of our speech. So I'll just go a little bit more into the person I was talking sometimes you just experience this and assume it is normal. You know, if you find out that something bad might happen, you should worry about it. You know, that was her idea. And she never really saw that or questioned it. She believed the voice was true. But now she's wondering if it's really true. She suddenly had the thought, well, is that true? Do I have to worry about something bad that might happen? You know? And of course, as soon as she had that thought, then she started seeing other things, right? Then when she started investigating whether that view was true, she had other thoughts coming. Like the thought, what it had she created. You can only stop feeling fear when you are completely safe. That's what her mind told her next. Well, that's a pretty tall order, but that's like a deeper layer of that mute. That's something operating that's declaring that. And so when she touches, she says also when she touches into that fear directly into her in the body, she feels like there's a sense of impending disintegration. So I was, of course, delighted by this. It made me scared or something. But this is classic behavior of the patterns that we have in our mind. So they're not neutral passive entities, but dynamic forces that will defend themselves. So as soon as she saw this idea that she might not have to worry about things that are potentially bad in the future, that pattern got activated and started saying, no, don't see through me, you know. It defends itself in some way. So we have this sense of impending danger or sort of it's like the mortal danger of being exposed, the pattern here, the mortal danger of being exposed and start generating some other things. So that's a sense that, that's a sign actually that we're starting to see here. This is a lot of what we're working on in mindfulness practice, seeing patterns in our behavior, seeing them defend themselves, and having the courage to say, no, I still don't believe. This relates to speech in the sense that you have speech in the mind, right? These thoughts that she starts hearing are basically inner speech. So I started talking about outer speech, but if we follow that, we might then of course realize that our inner speech are the ones that we also noticing which side our inner speech is on, whether it's those four or if it's more of the truly bringing concord, inoffensive, and beneficial type, can help us choose which of our inner speech to appreciate, pay more attention to, and which to just say, okay, I'm not going to go with that. The same idea is there's this choice. It's not any kind of external should. I don't know what's going on in your head. But if you have mindfulness that starts to see that, up to you, you can make the choice for how you want to make the mental well-being. So how do we transform in speech? And if we start noticing that there are thoughts that are unbeneficial for us, what do we do with that? The first reaction might be to say, bad. Don't think about that. I don't want that. I didn't want to see you. But this actually is abusive. It adds aversion onto something that's going on that already exists with it. It's like they're turning on to this anger on me. So we don't want to do that. There are alternatives. I would suggest one that's very powerful and effective is actually to just let that thought arise in fact. Don't identify with it. The reason that we get caught up and react is that we think that thought is coming from me, and I have to respond to it. But if the thought appears, if something dangerous is possibly happening, you need to worry about it. Instead of saying, no, I don't. I don't believe you. I could say, that's a thought. And just let it go by. It's not easy. At least you will succeed in that once again, but that's better thought instead of engaging directly with the content, you engage with the kind of emotion that's generating. So what is it that you need? There's a different answer at different times, and you don't need to fulfill that need, but just asking what that is to start to dig down to the root of why that's doing what's happening, what's happening, so on and so forth. But you have to be, you need to be pretty skillful and mindful. You don't want students to know very much about that. So, this also helps open compassion. These thoughts that are unskillful in your mind, to realize that they're coming from some place of suffering. And so then you can have compassion for that and feel the vulnerability that this thought has done. And you can have some compassion in those thoughts in your mind as well. That's a lot too. So changing our inner speech will also help to change our outer speech. Tying back then to when the mind is no longer filled with unskillful thoughts and unquestioned views, it becomes much more difficult to speak like the people at the bus stop. I mentioned at the beginning. Also, it becomes more difficult to engage in social media in the way that a lot of people do. And realize it's just not what they're feeling. So I would recommend, if this topic feels relevant, to engage someone with their inner speech and check whether this falls in place with an abusive appointment that you might have. And try not to add any energy to that in your mind. We really do have a choice about how we engage with our thoughts. And that then informs how we engage in the world. Good all around to get this energy and kind of really attention. Do you have any questions that come up on that? Still good? A couple. That pattern will tell you that it's necessary because it's a connection, right? But of course they're an impulse. They're an impulse dichotomy. One thing to consider is that if it's possible for the mind to, like if you're setting up your mind to be able to call somebody and be in a certain way, you can do that with somebody that you know very well and you're not letting them understand what you're just getting, a pathway in your mind that says I can do it. And how do you know you won't be able to control it in some other situation? So how is your mind in one situation that will bend over in the other? We always have to be aware of what we're conditioned to do in our mind. But it'll be an interesting way to where various forms of techniques. I used to have some of my friends that I eventually loses in my mind, bonding to mutual outrage. And this is when you, I don't know if that phrase makes sense, it's obscure language, but it's when you bond with other people by saying things like, yeah, that really sucks, doesn't it? You know, and the other person says, yeah. It's like between the two of you, you can really feel bonded because you both think that this particular thing is ridiculous or stupid or sucks or annoying. So you're bonding through your mutual outrage towards something. It's a very common pattern in our Western society. I don't know why. Truthfully, it's not that common in the culture. It seems to be kind of a, it doesn't feel good. This is not a good way to find it. And so I'm learning to change my dynamic with my friends because I decided I couldn't live with them. So slowly that changes and the friends who can't, and we end up making them not with them as much. And it's fine. We'll see. Yeah. What they're expressing is aversion. I mean, they're really expressing irritation or anger or annoyance or conceit, you know, superiority over something. Comes out. That actually isn't the kind of mind state that you want to validate necessarily. Probably that aversion is coming because they actually care about something and they need to push that. You know, if somebody's complaining that, you know, their workplace is so stupid about this particular policy, you know, it's irritating and it just, you know, messes up my ability to do work, what they're saying is, I care about doing a good job at work, and I'm being happy. And so then they're expressing the diversion. So what you want to validate is their care for their job. Not the aversion to the policy. So, finding the part that's skillful and validating that can be very challenging. Again, what are we conditioning in our mind or what are we conditioning in other people for our speech? So this can be a very interesting way of speaking. You can see a good feeling yourself to different if you're validating something with positive care on the side, just being stepped on by something, mean, I could even hear in the way you were describing it. Did you hear that? The way there was kind of this cycle going. This is exactly what the mind does. It gets into these cyclic loops of irritation, basically. And do you feel the effects of that in the body?
Yeah.
And it's beyond your control, exactly. So that's the underlying issue in some way. So there are views there of I should be in control, or I should be able to do this, or, and then that gets projected onto this should be a certain way, and it should be more friendly to me. This is an area to really watch the escalation in the mind. But there may be that initial irritation. But how do we take care of that then, so that it doesn't escalate? So maybe examining your relationship with technology, getting aside more a certain amount of time for working on the upgrades that we need to understand, things like that. Or, I know a friend who downgraded to a dumb phone. She just said, I mostly use my phone for communication, that's what I care about. I'll do email on my laptop 3 times a day when I happen to be in front of it, and the rest of the time I just have a phone call. And, you know, it worked well for her, actually, it was just stress. So there are things we can do if we're willing to kind of open up our relationship to this. The motivation being, yeah, I want to manage my stress. And there's multiple ways to manage that, internal or external, but I encourage you to be kind of creative. Certainly the view that your views should never change is a stress causing view. So there was a double layer of views there, right? So you have views, but you also have the view that they could change. That's a different thing. So in their case, the view that views shouldn't change was the sticking point. And that view is defending itself, essentially. I think trying to change other people's views is views are a tough area because they're so hard to see, actually. Probably the best place to work is with your own views, actually, and they're really familiar with how those work. Because we can't live without views. I mean, sometimes people think about how engaging they can go beyond their views and become non-dual, or I don't know what it is, but we can't live without views. We go through our day and understanding how things work and making assumptions and perceptions and so forth. The question going to the grocery store. It's an activity. Do you ever think about what you have to do? The one thing in the grocery store is, I've got my list of stuff, I'm going to get it as fast as I can, and I'm going to find the shortest one and get through so I can get home. You could have that view in the grocery store. It was probably involved in the grocery store and have to do at some point. We could also have the view of, I'm going to try to, you know, within social bounds, connect with people in the grocery store. Have you ever shopped that way? Which one would be better for your well-being, right? There are other options, too. You know, I'm going to be mindful of every step that I take at the grocery store. It's going to be walking meditation the whole time. That's a fun one. So that's another good one. The point of having a view or an orientation, whenever in Buddhism it's your orientation, not necessarily your opinion about something, it's a whole deeper layer. We should choose one that's beneficial to us. And so if we find that our very way of being is something that's not beneficial, we can question whether that's the correct view to be bringing into the situation. Now, on the other hand, if you were, say, an emergency ambulance driver carrying the view that you're going to be really mindful of your walking meditation while you're going to save somebody, that's not a useful view at that moment. You should forget about your walking and just help the person. You might want to still be mindful. But, you know, so it's not like there are blanket views that you carry everywhere. We can check in each situation, is my stance here helpful in some way? And sometimes even one that you think is pretty good might turn out not to be correct in the moment based on what, how the other person is, for example. You know, you come in with the idea, like my teacher, for example, one time, he worked in a restaurant and he's been for a little while. And one time he was came in a good mood, and he was really bouncy and kind of joking around with the other people. I mean, he thought he was just coming in with a friendly attitude, wasn't obnoxious. But it turned out that one of his co-workers, one of his family members, had just died, and he was not in the mood for joking. And my friend took him, my teacher quickly realized that. But at first he came in and was joking around, and then he saw the other person's mood, and he had to change his orientation. So, you know, our view may need to change based on the circumstances in order to be beneficial. So this is a whole large area of practice, and it requires mindfulness, not only internally, our work feeling, how we're stressed by our view, but also how the other people around us are responding to that too, so that we can harmonize ourselves with them. Does that help? If it sounds daunting, don't be daunted. Just do your best. You don't have to become a perfect social butterfly or just practice. You're becoming yourself. But we can become yourself.